everyone. It's your host, Polly Siegel. And for anyone who doesn't know me, I'm a licensed clinical social worker, certified addiction specialist, and master level trained mindfulness practitioner. I own a counseling practice in both Colorado and Illinois, and I specialize in trauma, OCD, and anxiety. If you live in either of those two states, feel free to reach out to me for a consultation and we can begin the therapeutic journey together. Now on to the good shit. Welcome to season 3 of Shit Talking Shrinks. Gosh, I'm so excited. I will be featuring experts in the healing space, and we're discussing a variety of mental health topics, the human experience, and society at large, while creating levity along the way. Get ready to laugh, learn a lot, and change your life for good. This episode is sponsored by Joyous. Okay, I have to tell you about this incredible company, Joyous. It's an at-home ketamine treatment that delivers ketamine to your door for $129 a month, which is absolutely unheard of because most ketamine treatment is hella expensive. And what ketamine does is it helps our prefrontal cortex work more optimally. And the prefrontal cortex helps with decision-making, problem-solving, emotional regulation. It's the part of the brain that gets us through hard shit. And so if you're someone who has struggled with anxiety and depression and you've tried antidepressants or you've tried mood stabilizers and they haven't helped, ketamine is absolutely the next step. And I have seen my clients thrive while using ketamine. Joyous makes it super easy to access this life-changing medicine, and you can start the process by visiting www.joyous.team. You guys, you got to get on it and try it. Trust me, you won't look back. Hey, everyone. We have the most fabulous guest today. Truly. Like I'm like a, what do they call it? A groupie for you. I'm a little groupie.
Oh, that's funny.
Who are your other groupies, by the way?
My other groupies? I have these things, these people call top fans on Facebook, and they respond within about 10 or 15 minutes of me doing something. And they're just great people. I have a Facebook group and they've all joined this group. But you know, my husband, who's quite sarcastic, like when the TEDx talk came out, he came up and he goes, "Margaret, they're like reporters outside." And I went, "Yeah, right."
There probably were though. So for anyone who doesn't know, this is Dr. Margaret Rutherford. She's an author, Perfectly Hidden Depression. Her TED talk just came out, which I was, again, top fan, first to listen. And then you also have a private practice where you do your clinical work and a podcast.
I mean, I really didn't want a podcast. I didn't want to write a book. I loved being a therapist. I've been a therapist for 30 years, and that's what I wanted to do. But when my son left for college, I just had some time. And then my husband was fighting an illness and I needed to stay home with him a lot. And so I thought, what can I do? And that's when I started writing. And that's a long story, which we don't have to go into. But anyway, it's been a great decade or a little bit more of being online and having certain ideas come to fruition and getting to meet people like you.
So I want to focus on the TED Talk because I find it to be an extension of your book, a more maybe accessible, quick way to digest a lot of the messaging and the work and the research that you've done. As I was listening to the TED Talk, what stood out to me is the camouflage and the masking and the connection to perfectionism, where someone can be presenting as lively and thriving and well and has such a full and robust life. But if you peel back the layers, there's so much suffering and pain. That really resonated with me.
That got started way back in 2014 when I was going to write a just a regular blog post for that week. And I was thinking about these people that definitely came to my office with camouflage on, well armored, not really wanting me to see what was going on. And sometimes I thought they really weren't aware what was going on. I mean, either what in the hell's going on? I don't know. And I wrote about them and I just grabbed this term out of the air and I called it the perfectly hidden depressed person. Are you one? And the damn thing went viral. And so then it was on the HuffPost and I got these hundreds of emails. It's like you're in my head. And I mentioned that in the TED Talk, TEDx talk. It's not a TED Talk. I want to make sure it's TEDx. People have said, well, are they really depressed? Because they don't fit the criteria In fact, if they look, they'll even say, oh my God, my life's so much better than that. What am I doing looking at this at 2 o'clock in the morning, going up and wondering if I'm depressed? I feel ashamed of that. But this camouflage was literally created when these folks probably were children and they were experiencing, oh gosh, a myriad of things, abuse, neglect. Those are the two that come to mind immediately, but even enmeshment and just being in families that you don't talk about painful emotions. You don't talk about anger or sadness. And so they didn't ever develop the language for that. Then said, well, you know, it's kind of like if you don't have any food in the refrigerator, you decide you're not hungry. Well, if you're not allowed to talk about painful emotions in your family, you decide, well, I don't need to do that. I don't have to do that. And so you repress them or compartmentalize them, and it becomes this camouflage. And so, in fact, I have a family member who's now deceased, who is my brother, who after he looked at some of the writing about it, he goes, are you writing about me? And I thought, well, it could be. Well, I won't say his name. Anyway, there are a lot of people like this.
But would you say that the camouflaging or the masking is truly an adaptation that these individuals have had to develop in order to survive within their environment?
Yes, I do. Exactly. Greatly, very nicely put. I use the word strategy in the book, and I wish I hadn't used that word because it makes you think that some little kid at 7 years old is in their room, you know, thinking, well, how am I going to survive this? You know, and that's not it at all. It's more just sort of a natural, very human adaptation, to use your word, great word. You know, we all do that. If we grow up in a family where there's a lot of anger, we don't show anger. If we grow up in a lot of family where there's a lot of love and caring, then we become someone who's loving and caring. We tend to do for others what is done for us. We are molded by that. So you're exactly right. Again, I have been floored by the response, especially around the world to the book. It's done well in the United States, but it's, I mean, the Koreans, they had a bidding war over the rights for it. Which, because if you think about all these K-pop people who have killed themselves, who look like they are going great, I think it's a real problem in that country. I continue to be gratified by it and honored by people writing me and saying, I don't know how you figured this out, but it's me.
What you just said is so profound to me. Do you find that there are certain cultures, I know you mentioned Asian culture, where there is almost a dismissal of perfectly hidden depression, or maybe an aversion to that concept?
Not necessarily an aversion to the concept, because hopefully it would feel relieving to have words to put it to. There is an aversion to everything not looking perfect. There is a tendency, I think, in that culture. I mean, I've had Asian Americans reach out to me who said, certainly, this is not something that was allowed in our family. You obeyed the family's rules. You did what you were supposed to do. You were highly accomplished. I've had my other minority people reach out to me and say, you know, my family gave me the message that I must succeed because I was the heir. You know, I was the heir apparent and they were all going to live through me. I was the first through college. I was the first of this. I was the first that. And so I had to put that armor on. Because in order to succeed the way I needed to, and being a minority, I had to be better than everybody else, constantly better than everybody else.
You know, it's really interesting, and I don't know if your research or anecdotal experiences have encountered this, but growing up in a very Jewish bubble, I went to an all-Jewish school. I lived in a very tight Jewish community in Kansas City. And there's a lot of that presentation of wanting to make sure everything looks peaches and cream. And everything looks, you know, put together and perfect. And there's a lot of emphasis on image and maintaining social status. I see that. And I wonder how many people in my own community back home are suffering because of that cultural pressure, that expectation, or that cultural value that's placed in Judaism.
Again, you know, I've been accused of taking resilience and pathologizing it and saying something's wrong. There's something wrong with courage. There's something wrong with resilience. There's something wrong with getting it done, even when it's hard. And I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that when that kind of drive is driven by, I have no other options. I cannot ever stop and admit I'm tired. I'm fighting this sense of somebody's going to find out who I really am, that I'm not this image of myself. And so you constantly drive yourself, that's what's called maladaptive perfectionism or destructive perfectionism. There's a constructive twin it has. It can be very destructive. So I think that is a great point. And you're right. There are several religious communities that push for this. Again, I love that the definition of courage that we have coming to as a culture is not that their courage is a lack of fear, but courage is feeling afraid and then going on. In fact, that's what I very much felt during the TEDx. I was scared to death and very nervous, but I had to find the courage to do it.
In the TEDx talk, you mentioned there's a story of Natalie, right? Earlier in your career, although I think you were 8 years into your clinical career, so it's not like super early. And it was a really profound experience because, as you said, on the outside, and this is just my interpretation and how I internalized your message in the talk, of really seemed like such a robust and life filled with vitality and things seemed good, but the signs were missed.
By me.
But it sounds like probably by others too.
Yes, but I wanted to make sure that people knew that I was counting myself in the crowd of, this is hard to see. The whole point of the second half of the talk was about, you know, how can we prevent or what can we do about people who don't want to reveal pain? They don't know how to reveal pain. It never would occur to them to even do that in any kind of transparent way. How can we as a culture begin to change that? Again, that best friend I was talking about, when she first read the preface of the book, the Natalie story is also the preface of the book. She said, Margaret, you can't put this in the book that you went to a patient's house, basically broke in. This is so unethical. And I said, well, the better part of the story is that she may not be alive today if I hadn't done that. The essence of the message is that suicidal thinking is actually normal. Suicide isn't normal, but suicidal thinking is very normal. You're a therapist. I'm a therapist. We know that people think about dying or killing themselves all the time. They just don't act on it. And they feel like they can talk about it in therapy. You know, we need to convey that to our culture, because I think the general belief is that if someone comes into a therapist's office and talks about suicide, we're going to put them in the hospital immediately. And that's not it at all. So I'm certainly promoting transparency about any kind of emotional pain that people might be in. And that if we moved in that direction more, and there's certainly even some wonderful research, there's wonderful research going on by John Summers Flanagan in Montana, I think. Calls it a strengths-based suicide assessment, which is all about talking about it and talking about it very openly and being curious about it and wanting someone to not see this suicidal thinking as something they need to be ashamed of, but that we talk about it like we talk any other feeling.
Right, right. Well, and as I was listening and having my clinical hat on, it was a beautiful reminder of how often we as clinicians might be missing the signs of perfectly hidden depression because we're so tied to the criteria of the DSM-5. And I loved that you mentioned the DSM-5, like where it's the structured Bible that we're all taught to like be very attached to. And it's our guiding force. It's our Bible. And it's like, wait a second. The DSM does not capture perfectly hidden depression.
It doesn't capture a lot of things. It is a very subjective document. And in fact, I got tickled, Polly, when I looked at myself, because I almost spit out the word statistical. I said diagnostic and statistical manual.
Yep.
I got tickled. I went, whoa, shit. That I'm sort of showing my feelings. It's like I'm a witch going, statistical.
Yeah.
I've listened to Bessel van der Kolk, who's this, of course, wonderful researcher and clinician. And he was in on the very beginning of the DSM, or at least he's been in it for later versions. And he stresses the point that it was never the intention of the creators of the DSM that it would become this rigid, you must have this in order to be diagnosed with, you know, this. It was to give an international language to people all over the world to kind of, okay, this, we're sort of agreeing, this looks like this is anxiety. We're sort of agreeing this is PTSD. We're sort of agreeing that this is depression. And yet it's become this thing that is as an early clinician, I would get it out and think, well, now, wait a minute, how many of these criteria does this person have? And now it's like, oh, Lord, I'm not going to do that unless I have to, for insurance, I have to.
Well, now it's kind of like, fuck that, because we see all of the flaws of the DSM and the limitations of the DSM and how much we might be missing as we relate to clients or try to understand clients or be able to map out their presentation. Of course, we're going to miss things if we blindly abide by the DSM because it's not comprehensive.
I will say that I've had patients feel relieved that it's like, oh, this is bipolar disorder, or oh, it helps them understand what they have been experiencing and even suffering from for a long time. And so they feel, I remember a woman very clearly who was a professor in our community, and she had some combination of OCD and bipolar too. She was so relieved. She said, I just thought I was crazy, you know, and to actually have a name for it and to see it in black and white was very helpful to her. And so, you know, I understand that it has its use, but at the same time, clinicians are overly dependent on it. When you have somebody who looks like their life is going great and walk in your office and you think, well, you almost like unconsciously go, well, they're not depressed, you know?
I think a lot about, and I don't want to pull away from the topic, but, you know, my specialty is OCD. And there are hundreds of different subtypes of OCD, but we are told to use the Yale-Brown assessment. And when you go through it, there can be this rigidity where someone's like, well, my obsessions kind of look like this, but the subtype doesn't describe it that way. So do I really have OCD? And I'm like, oh, 100% you do. But if we just looked at the Yale-Brown assessment, we would really question that subjective experience. And I think that's inherently problematic. And so I find that a lot when I do my OCD work to really share with clients that OCD will latch on to absolutely anything that you're not willing to tolerate the distress of. If you can't sit in the discomfort of it, that is a breeding ground for OCD to be like, hello, I'm here. But that's the limitation. So I think, you know, I hope our listeners can really hear that, like, the DSM is definitely helpful and has provided so much insight for us as clinicians. And at the same time, it doesn't capture the entire picture. And that's where I think perfectly hidden depression is so powerful, so that people can really start to be seen in a way where the DSM wouldn't see them.
I appreciate that. And I hope so too. I remember being interviewed by someone who also has her own podcast, obviously, and she's a clinician. And she said, after reading about perfectly hidden depression, I've added a question to what I ask my folks when I say, you know, I've got them in an initial session. And she says, I'll say, well, do you have thoughts about killing yourselves? And they say, no, I really don't. But then she said, the second question is, if you had them, would you feel like you could talk about them? No, would be the honest answer there, or would be an answer. They could say, yes, I guess I could. But, you know, if they would identify with perfectly hidden depression, they probably couldn't. So maybe they don't have it, you know, and so you'd also don't want to harass somebody into, you know, telling you they do when they don't. But she said, you know, she's been surprised about how many people might say, well, you know, I don't know if I could do that or not. And it opens this whole window of, you know, well, so what about your anger? What about your, you know, your grief? What about your jealousy? What about any other of these feelings that we have deemed bad feelings, harmful feelings? And what, how are we going to set the stage where we can talk about it?
I want to take a quick pause to talk about our sponsor, a company called BetterHelp. It's an online therapy platform where all the therapists are licensed and accredited professionals. It's affordable. You pay a low flat fee for therapy with your therapist, and it's convenient. Do it at your own time and at your own pace, and you can communicate with your therapist as much as you want and whenever you feel is needed. And more importantly, it's effective. Thousands of people have benefited from therapy using BetterHelp, and we're really grateful to offer all of our listeners 10% off your first month. So if you're interested in receiving therapy ASAP, click the link in our show notes and you can get started. And you get to save money. When we think about this term of perfectly hidden depression, is there generational differences where you find that maybe Gen X and boomers are more inclined to mask versus millennial and Gen Zers?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think if they belong in this particular, you know, category of perfectly hidden depression, which again, is not a diagnosis. I'm not pretending to be some kind of, you know, genius that came up with some other diagnosis. It's not that at all. It's what I call, in fact, a syndrome, which is just kind of a, when certain behaviors and beliefs are found together. But anyway, I think the reason why people hide may be different or have this armor. I think we baby boomers were told, wear it or else. I mean, I was told as a kid, you know, if I couldn't be nice, go to my room. I certainly couldn't be angry or couldn't be sad about something. I just was sent to my room until I could act like a lady. So that was one message. I think millennials and Gen Zers at this point have gotten the message that it's much more permissible and even welcome for them to talk about their emotions and even to seek therapy. But they've also been, they've been parented differently. They have a lot less. I think when y'all were on my podcast, you said they don't have as much resilience. And I so agree with that. They're scared of adulting. I was working with somebody yesterday who, you know, is on that cusp of getting out of college. And all of a sudden she's faced with decisions she's never had to make. And she's really struggling with the confidence to make them. So that's another reason to find some kind of avenue that you just, okay, well, what does everybody else want me to do? And I'll do that. And I'll look perfect and I'll act perfect. And I'll look like I've got the world by the tail. And I'll look like I have a great Instagram account or TikTok, you know, account. I'll be crushing it on TikTok, but I won't have a real stability.
So if someone is listening and they're wondering like, well, gosh, am I missing the signs in a friend or a loved one or a coworker? Like, what if I'm not picking up on this internal pain that someone's experiencing because of the masking or the camouflage? How would you invite someone to start to explore perfectly hidden depression or at least bring awareness to that type of attunement with someone?
So it's not them, it's someone they care about?
Yeah. Or they're wondering like, well, am I missing the signs in people that I love? Because if it's so hidden, then, well, gosh, I could be missing it.
Well, I think you talk about your experience with them. I know that your brother was put in prison last year and you never talk about it. You know, if that had happened to me, I would have a lot of different feelings. And I just, and they might say something like, oh, you know, I don't even think about that. Or if it starts to bother me, I'll let you know. Or I'm just not that kind of person that dwells on that. They'll give you these hints that they're uncomfortable with you bringing it up and they're trying to avoid the conversation. But if you're gently persistent, you know, after I stop to think about it, you don't share much of yourself with me or others. And so I think I've had a lot of people who are married or partnered with folks like this. And they say, they ask this exact question. You know, just like any kind of conversation, you don't come in with, you don't do this and you don't do that. And why is that? You talk about your own experience first. And then, of course, have the kind of conversation that where you're also being vulnerable in that conversation. And so you're modeling that for them. And they might even feel safe with you to begin to do a little bit of that themselves.
Yeah, I think it's so important to emphasize the compassionate nudging. Because so often when someone meets resistance, their natural inclination is to retreat or pull back. So like when that person goes, oh, you know, I haven't thought about my brother much, or, you know, he made his own decisions and he ended up in prison, but that's his life. There's that like tension to be like, all right, I'll back off. But that might be the moment to continue to be curious and exploratory with that compassionate or gentle nudging to go, well, gosh, I can only imagine how hard that might be to not have access to your brother or to feel distanced from your brother. And I'd love to hear more about it or hold space for it. So I think, you know, that's a good tangible tool, is maybe we're just coining it compassionate nudging when you need to.
I love that term. I may steal that term.
Yeah. This topic is so brilliant. It's very meaningful to me because I actually have a friend right now that I think is doing a lot of camouflaging. And I feel very worried for her. And I have tried the compassionate nudging route, and I feel a bit unsuccessful in it because there's the armor and the boxing gloves are fierce right now.
That's hard to watch. That's really hard to watch. I certainly have experience with that myself. Of course, you know, the easy answer is, well, buy my book, you know.
Which you should. Buy her book, folks. I agree with that.
But there are 60 exercises in the book that are hopefully designed to take you from a place where you're extremely uncomfortable even thinking about any of this to gradually, compassionately nudging yourself to be able to say, okay, you know, this is something that's going to be helpful for me to realize about myself and to do something about. So, Polly, it's like anything else. Most of us are not going to be, we're not ready till we're ready. How many patients that you see have you said, why couldn't have I figured this out, you know, 10 years ago or 5 years ago? And basically, it's, you can say things like, well, I'm going to keep noticing, I'm going to keep looking. And if it's okay with you, I'm going to keep on talking about what concerns me because you know, you are on my radar as somebody who just seems to be avoiding the topics that might, it's harder for you to talk about.
I know I'm using a personal example here, but I find it to be so relevant to our discussion. How would you advise if someone puts a very hard boundary of, I'm not willing to talk about this. I don't want to go there. I hear you're concerned. I appreciate it, but back off. Because again, it's being masked, but intuitively you can feel that person is suffering.
Well, you don't have really any other recourse except to say, okay, I get it. I can't unsee what I've seen. I can't unknow what I think I know. And the very fact that you're backing off from me this vehemently may suggest that there's some reality there. But I will honor that, but it's not that I'm going anywhere. You know, find your own way to say something like that. You know, I don't care what your language is. Don't use mine. Just use something that makes sense to you, you know, to say, well, whether you want me to or not, I'm going to care about you. We all have teenagers, or some of us have reared teenagers that just use those skills you had when you were rearing your teenager. I don't want to talk to you about that. Okay. All right.
I guess I feel a little bit validated in your response because that's what I've done is I've said, okay, I have to respect the boundary, yet I am concerned and my love for you is fierce and I will continue to show up to show that I care. It's just a very hard place because I know if I look behind the curtains, there's a lot more going on than what's being presented. And that can be very tricky for the person on the other side who's like, gosh, just doesn't seem like things are okay, but I feel stuck or trapped in having to navigate it.
You can't force somebody to be ready to talk or to be more transparent about what's really going on with them. And again, with perfectly hidden depression, there is a real terror of that kind of transparency because, again, they did not experience any safety or security around that issue much younger age. So all of that has been absorbed big time. And so every fiber of their being is going, no, 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 you know, stay away. You know, you just hope that you can make a difference slowly, but, you know, kind of surely. I use the metaphor in the book. Working with someone like this is kind of like a Jenga game where you have to pick the piece very carefully that you can remove or jostle a little bit while the whole thing doesn't come crumbling down, you know. So there's some tiny steps that need to happen.
It's like kind of the strategy in which we use. We have to be very gentle, but also tactful. I know we have a few more minutes. What are other tips or tricks in navigating this?
Well, let me say, first of all, and I say it about, I don't know, 100 times in the book. It's a 210-page book, but I say this frequently. If you've got severe trauma, don't do this work by yourself. You need someone else there for your stability. Someone who can see you and move with you. If it's severe trauma, then you're asking yourself to do something that's way too hard. The other thing I think that is a very, very useful, when you're ready to do it, useful kind of exercise is what's called a trauma timeline, which is going back and looking at yourself at different ages, not blaming crap on people, but just saying, this was a very unwelcome or even abusive thing that happened to me. and it molded me, it changed me. And you begin to do that for all the different years of your life. And so you then start saying, okay, so how does this all work together? I probably wouldn't have done X in my 30s if Y hadn't happened to me when I was six. And so, you know, you begin to make these, see these patterns and these relationships between what has happened to you and who you are, which is, you know, again, hopefully as a culture, we've stopped asking the question, what's wrong with you? And instead have said, what's happened with you? The other thing though, Polly, is I think insight's great. Insight's very, very helpful. Aha moments are fun to watch when somebody's having them. They're fun to have, or not fun necessarily all the time. Shit, that's not true. They are good to have because everything sort of lights up and you go, oh, wait a minute, I've never thought of it like that before. But where you get hope is when your behavior starts changing or when your emotions change, when you always get mad about something, but you don't, when you never risk something, but you do, when you have never been playful and all of a sudden you found yourself skipping down the street and not caring what your neighbors thought. You know, it's kind of like, okay, what is changing in me? And what is, you know, I think that's where you get your hope is when you begin breaking out of that armor in Perfectly Hidden Depression's case and begin to say, I don't have to be this contained, restricted, boxed in, trapped in this cage person. I can actually express myself, whether it's I'm expressing joy, I'm expressing pain. It is such a gift to give yourself. So, I mean, I have been blessed to work with several of these people. And I tell the story in the TEDx about a guy that it was a true story. There was this guy and I didn't know he was internationally known. I'm not in his field. He just had to tell me he's internationally known. And so, you know, he had on a nice suit and had a nice car. So I guess he was right. But he came in and he was so ashamed of himself about something that had happened. But he literally came in my office one time and was so happy. And I said, what is going on? And he said, I was in a plane. I was openly journaling and I was writing about my dad, which was the source of a lot of his unhappiness. And he felt a tear run down his cheek. And he said, you know what? I didn't give a shit. I didn't care that anybody could see that. I'm walking out of that cage. I am out of it. I'm leaving it. It's just no longer going to be something that I'm ashamed of, that I have feelings. So when I was practicing that speech, I would start crying every time I tell that story. And if I started crying that day, that would have been, I mean, I'd gotten tears in my eyes. And so if that happened, it didn't because I was so nervous. I don't think I had any extra tears available. It's been incredible to do the work and to hear the stories, and I hope to hear more.
I hope to hear more too, and for me to have a keen eye trying to like see if I can ask the right questions, be inquisitive, be curious, be compassionate, nudge a little bit, all of that as a clinician, but also as a friend. So I hope everyone today just has a new take on depression. Again, we're all kind of used to the stereotypical presentation of depression, but I think the truth is it comes in a lot of different forms and it's masked and camouflaged and that we need to just be aware of all of that. So thank you for joining Shit Talking Shrinks today. All of her beautiful work will be in the show notes, the link to the TEDx talk, your clinical practice in case anyone's in the area. I'm just grateful. So thank you for being here.
Polly, thank you.
Okay, we'll catch everyone later.